Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 23rd, 2003. Today's session is entitled, A World in Which We Cannot Walk By on the Other Side, presented by former Illinois State Senator Paul Simon. The number is 2003-04. Let's listen in.
Right here, I felt like cheering at the end of your sermon. And the story of J. Maple ought to be an inspiration to all of us. Walking by on the other side. That comes from the story of the Good Samaritan. Actually, the phrase Good Samaritan is in some ways an unfortunate phrase. It's not a biblical term. The hated Samaritan would be a more accurate description of the attitude of that time. And if Christ were telling the story today, we would feel very uncomfortable, as the people did then. The people who'd walk by on the other side would be a Lutheran layman, a Lutheran pastor. He'd pick on us. And the person who stopped, maybe a communist, maybe the village drunk, the most unpopular person you can think of where you live is the person who stopped. We have to not find excuses for walking by on the other side when there are people in need. Someone mentioned to me last night the signs God Bless America that appeared immediately after September 11th all over. And in a way, it was good to see that, but I would have liked to have seen signs that said, God bless America and the rest of the world. You know, that would have reflected what our faith should be, I think. And it becomes so easy to almost deify ourselves. When we talk about others as the axis of evil, we're kind of implying we're part of the axis of good. And I'm not suggesting that there aren't forces of evil in the world, but they're also within us. And we should be careful. If you had a family of 25 children and one child had one-fifth of all the toys and didn't want to share those toys with the others, even though the child used to, that family would be in trouble. That is the human family today. 1/25, we're 4% of the world's population. We have 1/5 of the world's goods. We used to share under the Marshall Plan, and our income has far more than doubled since that time, and we're not doing what we should, and the human family is in trouble. If I can find something I wanted to read here. Well, I don't have it. Let me talk about you mentioned, and I was pleased to hear you talk about what you're doing with water. Your congregation in Linwood. Let me tell you a little bit about the world water situation. For most of the history of civilization, we had about 10 million people on the face of the earth. 1830, we hit 1 billion. 1930, 2 billion. We now have about $6.25 billion. And in the next 50 to 90 years, depending on whose projection you believe, it will taper off at about 11 billion people. So the line on population is going up like this. There's another line on water, and it is flat. And you don't need to be the world's greatest scientist to understand we're headed for some trouble. We're fortunate in the United States. We have 4% of the world's population, 8% of the world's fresh water. But I recall when Parade magazine did a condensation of a book I wrote about water, primarily the letters I had received in response were from the southwestern portion of the United States, understandably. But I remember getting some letters from the islands in Washington. Never thought about water shortage in Washington or Oregon. Here's a from a population publication. Let me read this. India, with more than 1 billion people and the second most populous country behind China, is expected to join the precipitously growing list of water-stressed countries by 2025, when nearly half the world population is projected to face water shortage. Nearly 40% of those living in urban areas are below the poverty line and have no access to water. In rural India, where 750 villages were without water resources in 1985, the number rose to 65,000 villages by 1996, reported the Hindu, a New Delhi-based newspaper. And here's another little item, particularly we ought to be aware of. Frequent backaches from carrying heavy pots of water were reported by mostly women respondents. The villagers of Ranchur, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, felt they were unable to send their children to school as they were required for household chores, primarily collecting water. Water is a women's issue. You go to the developing nations and the people who have those pots on the top of their head or a pole with water on both ends, those are women, and in some cases, older children. The intelligence agencies of the United States, CIA and the others, periodically give a report to the President of the United States where we're going to be in 15 years. Just before Bill Clinton left office, they reported to Bill Clinton and they said, in 15 years, the great resource shortage in the world will not be oil, but water, and there will be regional wars fought over water. UNICEF says 14 million people a year die because of poor quality water, 9.5 million of them children. 9.5 million children dying, if you divide it by the year, that means today, September 23rd, I think it is, September 23rd, 630 times as many children are dying because of poor quality of water than were killed at Columbine High School. We were stunned at Columbine High School, as we should have been. But we hardly notice all these children who die quietly. Egypt gets 98% of its water from the Nile. Ethiopia is the source of 85% of the Nile to Egypt. Ethiopia has one of the highest birth rates in the world. Those two nations are on a collision course unless something happens. I mentioned being in the Middle East yesterday. When I was in Amman, Jordan, a city of 1 million people, You turn the tap on one day a week. Now, people who are middle income, upper income, can get little tiny trucks that bring water to their home. Poor people can't afford that. And they simply put the water in buckets and pans and store it for a week. And you know what happens. We ought to be paying attention. But, and let me give you an illustration. One of the producers of the NBC Evening News called me and said, if you ever have any good ideas for a story, give me a call. And I said, I have a good idea for a story right now. And I told her about the water situation. She said, I'll bring it up. About 3 days later, she called back and she said, well, we had a meeting of the producers. And she said, you have to understand, NBC is in a ratings war. And she said, water just isn't a very sexy subject. It doesn't improve ratings. Now, if there were more parishes like yours in Linwood, Washington, paying attention to water, NBC would be paying attention to water. The media follows what the public is interested in. And we have to generate interest on the part of the public. We are absorbed in entertaining ourselves. And much of the news is entertainment rather than real news. And I'll give you a very practical illustration. I was one night on Saturday Night Live with the singer, Paul Simon. And they announced at the beginning of the show, our host for tonight is Paul Simon. And the two of us went out and had this little argument about who should be the host. And of course, I lost the argument. And the next morning, I was on the David Brinkley Show. For about 2 weeks afterwards, wherever I went, people would come up to me and say, I saw you on Saturday Night Live. No one came up to me and said, I saw you on David Brinkley. We have to be paying attention to substance. And we have to be looking at our response. Of the 22 wealthy nations in the world, and the percentage of our income that goes to help the poor beyond our borders, we're 22nd, dead last. Denmark gives slightly more than 12 times as much in percentage terms as we do. Now you say, well, Denmark's a small country. But there are countries, France and Japan, have less than half our population and give more in absolute dollars than we give. I got my notes all mixed up here. Here's a story from Foreign Affairs, September, October, current issue. If talking about foreign aid, if these programs are funded as proposed by the president, and to the credit of the president, he has asked for an increase, but it is probable that Congress will cut it back. If these programs are funded as proposed, they will increase U.S. foreign aid from approximately $11 billion in 2002 to $18 billion in 2006. That is still, $11 billion is less than one half of 1% of our federal budget. $18 billion maybe moves it up to, depending what the final budget figures will be, up to about two-thirds of 1%. Pete Peterson, who was the Secretary of Commerce under Richard Nixon, chaired a committee of distinguished diplomats and others. And in the same magazine, Pete wrote, perceptions of the United States are far from monolithic, but there is little doubt that stereotypes of Americans as arrogant, self-indulgent, hypocritical, inattentive, and unwilling or unable to engage in cross-cultural dialogue are pervasive and deeply rooted. Also at the root of these negative attitudes is Americans' perceived lack of empathy toward the pain, hardship, and tragic plight of peoples throughout the developing world. That is, I think, an accurate assessment. And it is not simply those beyond our borders. I was asked to speak at the dedication of a library at a state university in Pennsylvania, Bloomberg State University, which I confess I'd never heard of before. But they asked me, since I've written a little in the Lincoln field, they asked me to compare Lincoln's time and our time. Well, all kinds of huge differences, you know, radio, television, computers, automobiles, and so forth. But an interesting thing, in Lincoln's time, the great military power was England. The great economic power was England. And among the semi-industrial nations, the nation that had the worst slums was England. We look back and we ask, how could this rich and powerful country have tolerated that? Today, the most powerful nation militarily is the United States. Most powerful nation economically is the United States. And among the industrial nations, the nation that has by far the highest percentage of its children living in poverty is the United States of America. And 50 years from now and 100 years from now, people are going to be asking about us. How could they have tolerated that? So many things. Healthcare. I mentioned yesterday. I think my first wife died 4.5 years ago of brain cancer, and she was undergoing chemotherapy. We paid $1,323 a pill for her chemotherapy pills. Now, we could afford it, and we had insurance covered most of that. What do poor people do in the United States of America? Now, as it turned out, it didn't make any difference for Jean's life. But if we couldn't have made it, we would have had that gnawing feeling, maybe if somehow we could have put the money together to buy those pills, her life might have been saved. Reaching out to the poor. Let me tell you about someone. And I can't think of his wife's name right now. Bill Carson retired from Chicago, went down to Santa Fe, New Mexico. When he's in Santa Fe, New Mexico, he read about Salazar Elementary School, which was testing way below what it should, way below averages in New Mexico. And he said, we ought to do something about that. He belonged to a United Church of Christ church there. I forget the name of the church. And Bill and his wife went there and said, could we get some volunteers who would, if we go to Salazar School, who would help these young people? Then Bill and his wife went to the principal there at the Salazar School. 90% of these children were from families in the below the poverty level, went to Salazar School and said, we're willing to volunteer and we have others who are willing to volunteer. They got over 70 people to volunteer, almost all of them from one small church. Salazar School has gone from being one of the worst schools in New Mexico to being an example of a good school. People in one church, retired people by and large, retired FBI agent, retired newspaper editor, and so forth, they did something. And it reflects on our faith. Cooperation with other nations also. So many examples that I can think of here. Landmines. Why can't we join the other nations of the world in outlawing the production and use of landmines? Now, we say it is because of the Korean situation. Frank Murkowski, who is the governor now of Alaska, was a senator, Republican senator from Alaska. Frank Murkowski and I flew in the first plane, American plane, to land in North Korea. And let me tell you, North Korea hardly has bicycles. North Korea is not about to invade South Korea. That's just a very, very thin reed of an excuse. And if anyone has any doubt where we should be, I would ask you to go to Angola. And Angola, along with Cambodia, has more landmines than any other countries. Just outside of the capital city, the Swedish Red Cross has a facility where they work out artificial limbs for children. And you see those children lined up. And if you're not for outlawing landmines, something's wrong with your heart. And something's wrong with your head, too. We clearly ought to be doing that. Earth warming, Kyoto Agreement. We use the excuse it's going to hurt our economy. It's interesting that the other things that we did to help our economy ultimately, and help the environment, ultimately helped our economy and not hurt it. The law of the sea, the mining of the sea. Elliot Richardson, who's now dead, but was a Republican Attorney General of the United States at one point, basically designed it, we won't go along. The International Criminal Court has been created. We say, no, we're not going to go along with that. Almost all the world's democracies have approved it. Almost all the dictators of the world have not approved it. We're on the side of the dictators. We really ought to be doing better. And then you look at areas of need, and sub-Sahara Africa just cries out. And we just have not responded as we should. I don't know what the latest appropriation is going to be, but it has been $800 million for the neediest area in the world. $800 million is what we get from 2/3 of 1 cent of a gasoline tax. It is nothing compared to the need in that area. 90% of malaria in the world is in sub-Sahara Africa. Child assistance. Here's our foreign aid budget for 2002 for Africa, for helping children. In Africa, 13.6 million. Asia and the Near East, 92.4 million. Europe and the Eurasian countries of former Soviet republics, 98.7 million. Where is the great need? In Africa. And we're not responding. And it's people. When I speak to Rotary clubs or those kind of groups, you can give the statistics, but you know, people's eyes glaze over. I tell about being in Malawi, visiting a refugee camp. This is when Malawi, a country then of 7 or 8 million people, Mozambique right next door, had a civil war. Malawi had 1 million refugees. Incidentally, we admitted last year in this big country 25,000 refugees. Little Malawi, 1 million refugees. And I went to this refugee camp in the southern part of the country, biggest refugee camp I've ever visited, 40,000 refugees. And the camp director said, would you be willing to talk to some of the refugees? And I said, if you want me to, I'll be happy to. And he divided them into men, women, and children. And they were just seated on the ground, very primitive. No PA system, huge, you know, many, many times as many as are gathered here. And I would shout, and the interpreter would shout after me. When I spoke to the children, maybe 15 feet from me was a little boy, about 10 years old, with a badly infected eye and insects on his eye. And I said to the camp director afterwards, is someone going to help that little boy? And the camp director said, we can only take care of emergencies. I've never forgotten that little boy. I don't know how his future ties in with the future of my 4 grandchildren, but I know that it does, and you know that it does. We simply can't ignore all these huge needs. And one of the things that we need, and that a marvelous man by the name of Reverend Leon Sullivan, Chip, you probably knew him, he was pushing was to try to get ties between countries in Africa and groups in the United States. When I was still in the Senate, when I would go to a Greek area in Chicago, people would ask me, what are you doing to help Greece? When I went to a Polish area, they'd say, what are you doing to help Poland? When I went to a Jewish area, they'd say, what are you doing to help Israel? When I went to an African-American area, hardly ever did anyone ask about helping Africa, because under slavery, the roots were severed. People don't have an identification. You know, are you from Senegal or Botswana or where you're from? And Leon Sullivan has been trying to tie things in. And I've spoken to the National NAACP Convention and other groups urging that we build some ties, and we've had just limited experiences doing it. Andy Young is working on it. I think it would be great if some congregations here, and it shouldn't just be African-American dominated congregations, if you would pick one country, and let me give you 2 examples. Pick one country where you would get 2 or 3 members of your congregation to go to that country and visit. And if you don't have 2 or 3 members who can afford it, try to raise money so that your congregation can pay half the way. Namibia is a country that has a sizable Lutheran population. Deep in South Africa. That would be a natural. If you're a little more venturesome, Liberia. It has some dangers, but here is a country that has more ties to the United States historically than any other country. I have been there 3 times. Jimmy Carter and I co-chaired monitoring the presidential election when Charles Taylor was elected, who didn't turn out to be a source for good in Liberia. But the capital city doesn't have running water, doesn't have electricity. You know, in the year 2003, country with ties all over to the United States. We ought to be doing something. We need some Americans who are paying attention to a country like Liberia. And little things can make a difference. When the Civil War was going on, I was there twice. One time I met with the president in Monrovia, and about all he controlled was Monrovia. And I said, if you have an election and Charles Taylor wins, will you turn it over to him? And he said, of course. I said, have you ever told Charles Taylor that? And he said, he knows that. So, and then we went through, and Senator Chuck Robb of Virginia and I were together on this one. We went through literally 12 checkpoints to get to Charles Taylor's headquarters. And I say checkpoints, this is not like crossing a border in Europe or something. These are, you know, little kids with big guns, and they say get out of the car, and you get out of the car, and you hope you're going to get back in the car. But anyway, we got to Charles Taylor, and I told him, and he, what the president had said in Monrovia. And he said, did he really say that? And I said, yes. I asked him, would you be willing to enter into peace negotiations? And he said, yes. Well, I sent a cable to the State Department, and we had peace negotiations in neighboring Abidjan and the Ivory Coast, but they fell apart. But if we had just a few more Americans interested in Liberia, we could just do so much good for that country. And I'd love to see someone from one of your congregations, and maybe a pastor himself or herself, going to one of them. Or you pick the country. The Bible says, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. I believe the opposite is also true. Where your heart is, there will your treasure be also. And we need to have our hearts touched. I talked at the fireside last night a little bit about Rwanda. 800,000 to 1 million people killed. We were indifferent, and the Rwanda problem has spread to neighboring Burundi and to what was Zaire is now the Congo. And the estimate is in the Congo 3.7 million people have been killed in that civil war there. And the United Nations has moved in. They've moved in with 5,000 troops. 5,000 troops in a land in turmoil that is bigger than Western Europe. You know, just woefully inadequate. 15,000 are being used in tiny Liberia now. And Liberia will at least temporarily have stability. HIV, AIDS in Africa, over 25 million people infected, over 17 million deaths. Just astounding figures. The story in the New Testament, Lazarus and the rich man. You know who we are. And it ought to disturb us. It's interesting that in England moved away from slavery long before we did, largely because of John and Charles Wesley, who had a grand total of 79,000 Methodists in that whole country. And almost all of them poor people. But they galvanized support. We have 6 to 7 million Lutherans in this country. What are we doing to influence policy? Well, we ought to be doing much more. Let me just a couple of final notes. One, I talked a little bit yesterday about prisons, and that it still bothers me a great deal how unresponsive and how overwhelming the need is. Here's a Here's from a magazine I read just on coming out here. There are 2 million prisoners in the United States, the highest per capita incarceration rate in the world, and more than 55% of men and 60% of women in prison are parents. The country's prison boom has thus torn apart families, most of them African American or Latino, and punished increasing numbers of children for their parents' crimes. 161 nations have a total income, their GDP, gross domestic product, their total income is less than the income of Walmart. You know, we're living in a world where people need to be helped. And we can all, if I may steal from the chaplain here, Mark, we can all be Jay Maples. We can all be reaching out and doing those extra things that really make a difference. And if we have the courage to call ourselves Christians, we have an obligation to do it. I think that's it. Now, let me stop and answer questions for a few minutes. All right. I always talk longer than I intend. Yes.
You spoke in your first presentation about being careful about knowing all the truth. And you just now spoke about the importance of influencing public policy. And we've, in various ways, been talking about being careful about how we are the conscience. You know, I'd like to be the conscience of the government. Jerry Falwell would like to also. From your experience, what works best in hearing from constituents who have a conscience, because corporate America doesn't? We were at a financial seminar, and I asked a question about social purpose investing, and we care about environment, etc. She says, we don't have any social purpose funds. We're here to make money for you, and you can take your money and you can use it for social purpose. And I have a hunch that corporate America, which strongly influences public policy, is rather devoid of conscience. So how do we go about that?
All right. Well, first of all, I'm not quite as pessimistic as you are. You know, I just read in Sunday's newspaper about Bill Gates giving, I think it was $158 million for malaria in Mozambique. There are people like Bill Gates. There are corporations. And incidentally, I am not a wealthy person, but I put my limited stock portfolio, I buy from companies where I see the leaders showing a social conscience. And I do better than Dow Jones doing it that way. I happen to have accidentally... let me tell you the story, because we have all kinds of opportunities that we usually don't seize, and I'm sure I haven't seized many of them. But I spoke in Omaha at a literacy banquet, and this fellow came up to me. I didn't recognize him afterwards. And I said, my name is Warren Buffett. He said, are you by any chance free for lunch tomorrow? Well, as it turned out, I was. Well, we get together about twice a year for lunch or dinner, and Warren Buffett is very much concerned. Warren Buffett says, who is one of the two wealthiest people in this country, says that we simply have to respond to the needs of the poor more, or our whole country is going to diminish in terms of our effectiveness in the world. And he's absolutely right. But to seize the opportunity. So there are people of conscience in businesses and labor unions and, you know, everywhere. But we have to appeal to them, and I'm a great believer in telling stories about people. That's why I told the story about the little boy in Malawi. You know, you can see that little boy with the infected eye, and you know we ought to help. But if you just say, you know, there are so many million starving in Africa, somehow it doesn't grab people. But we need leadership in the church, in business, everywhere, and in government that prods our conscience. And people really will respond. Just like, you know, your church, they have responded. My guess is, Mark, you're the leader on that. I don't know. But he grabs the ball and people respond. Yes. Yes, I am. If you count the Missouri Synod. Yes. First of all, our local preacher does a very good job. Bob Gray happens to be my pastor, and so I'm pleased. Now, I am gone, I would say, one out of three Sundays, or maybe a little more than that. And frequently, pastors will have these little things for children. And I find frequently I get more out of those. You know, because it is, you know, you're really speaking in terms of things that people understand. I guess I would like to be challenged. I'm not saying that you should get up and say, as a pastor, everybody ought to write to Congressman so-and-so and support this bill. But you ought to creatively look at your church structure, at your community of faith. And how can that be utilized to respond? Can you just ignore Matthew 25? I don't think. Are most churches ignoring Matthew 25? I hate to say it, I think most of them are. Yes. Well, the answer is I don't do as good a job as you think I do. I do remember you're Mary, so I do remember your name. But if you ask me to go around and name all the other people I've met here, I can't do that. But I try to look for the stories that, you know, the real life experiences. And people are interested in that. You know, I can talk about the prison population generally, but when I talk about Robert Felton Jr., people start paying attention. And so I think we have to be keeping in mind the big picture, but then make it alive by telling a story about people. Yes. I think we should be good listeners, yes. And I'm not saying that I am always a good listener, but we should listen to the struggles that people have. One of the things I do in my classes, no matter what course I'm teaching, the first day I say, will You give me an autobiography of yourself, 2-page autobiography. And here's just a normal-looking group of students. All of a sudden, you see all the problems. Here's a student in my last class whose father was murdered by her mother. You know, she has some problems. But I try to listen, and I'm not always good at it. Yes. That what?
The current administration is not very enlightened since they don't see it.
Well, you may get a partisan answer for that kind of a question. I think, in fairness, I should say there is a tendency on the part of all administrations to follow where the campaign contributions come from. And when the campaign contribution, the 43 million Americans who don't have health insurance are not big campaign contributors. And so this is a problem. Now, I candidly think, and you have to take this with a grain of salt, I think the Republican Party has more of a problem in this area than the Democratic Party. There are others here who I'm sure would differ with that assessment. Yes? I'm going to need some help.
Can you come closer and state that we don't have a mic?
I'm talking about broad-based community organizing and how churches are starting to see that if they can't take action on their own and make a difference, that they can do this with other groups and faith groups and civic groups across the whole community. And pay attention then if they have that kind of power. And taking seriously and self-interest and the way the world really is in making a difference. Have you seen that at work yet?
Yes. And I think I have seen it at work, and I think it has two good things. One is it gets something done to meet a need. And second, it gets the community of faith to reach out to one another. I read in the Lutheran, incidentally, I think you have an excellent denominational publication in the Lutheran, but a congregation in Washington after September 11th, a Roman Catholic and a Lutheran congregation met, and they held hands around a mosque where people had been threatening. I don't know, you maybe know the name of the congregation or where. Pardon? Was it your church?
Us and several others.
All right. Well, he prompted me to say that. I think that they're reaching out. Lutherans and Roman Catholics holding hands to protect Muslims says something that is very, very good. And it's good for everybody. Yes?
Senator Simon, you mentioned population, and overpopulation is a big concern that I have. I remember when we passed the 4 billion mark, and now we're over 6 billion, and I'm just 34. And I think that a lot of these are great intentions we have, but a generation from now, even some of these best intentions might be off or not if there are simply too many people to go around for the resources, even if we do share. And you also mentioned that for resources. Do you know of an ethical way, something not what China is doing, in other words, a way that we can, as a human family, have a doable, workable commitment to creating a healthy balance of world population?
Yes. First of all, the population numbers in terms of people in a family are gradually going down. And that's the encouraging side. The second thing is, since we have, we can't pass legislation to help the UN Population Fund, which I think we ought to be helping, but because of, and it gets tied up in the abortion question, and it is clear, the law, our statutes say, you can't give funds to any country or to any agency where the money is used for abortion, but still we can't get the UN Population Fund. But we can do something else, and we ought to be doing much more on that, and that is pushing education for women. You increase the education level for women, and those numbers of children per family go down fairly dramatically. Second, I am less pessimistic than you are in terms of our ability to feed 11 billion people, which is, and that 11 billion may be off the mark because it assumes that our lifespan is going to be about the same as it is now. And I think that the reality is our lifespan is going to be growing. So my guess is it's more likely to be 12 or 13 billion. But we talked about water before. 97% of the Earth's water is salt water. Of the remaining 3%, two-thirds is tied up in icebergs and snow. So we're living on 1% of the Earth's water. If we can find, and we're making progress on this, if we can find more effective and less expensive ways of converting salt water to fresh water, you can put water on the desert and you can grow crops. It doesn't work on stone, but anything other than stone. Saudi Arabia was growing 8% of their own food. Saudi Arabia has pushed for desalination. They, of course, have very cheap energy. I don't know what the cost them for a barrel of oil, maybe 50 cents or whatever. Saudi Arabia today is a food exporting country. So if we can tap into water more effectively, I think we can feed 11 or 12 or 13 billion people. Yes, but I do favor the family planning efforts.
Is it true that the underlying reason for us being in Iraq is because of water rights?
Are we in Iraq because of water rights?
No. And if you were to ask me the follow-up question, why are we in Iraq? I don't have a good answer for you on that. I just think it was, and I recognize it was popular, and no one is in love with Saddam Hussein. I've only been in Iraq one time. I landed about 4 in the afternoon. And an Iraqi in the diplomatic corps was all shaken up. An Iraqi employee of the British Embassy had given them agricultural statistics for Iraq. And I assume, figuring there's no harm in giving agricultural statistics, but the Iraqi government viewed it as espionage. They arrested him and executed him an hour later. And it is not a. He was not a good government. But there are a lot of other governments that aren't good, and we just can't go around invading governments that we don't like. Under international law, we have a right to invade if we're facing an imminent threat of attack. I don't think we were faced with an imminent threat of attack. I guess my feeling is that we saw this, what the terrorists did, and we wanted to look like we were doing something. And in fact, by invading Iraq, we have increased terrorism rather than decreased terrorism. I think it was an unfortunate decision. Yes?
Regarding your point on hope, you talked about your stock portfolio. And what I'm talking about is I'm interested, where's a good place to invest in the future?
Well, Lutheran World Relief, and I recognize most of you are Lutherans here, I think does a very effective job. Of the non-religious organizations, one that has impressed me is Doctors Without Borders, a French group. They were, I went to Somalia just before we invaded Somalia, and I hope I never see anything like I saw there again. But just about everybody had abandoned the communities that I visited because there was just no government, you know, and it was just kids running around with guns, and it was terrible. But Doctors Without Borders was there. They have been willing to take more risks than other groups. But there are a lot of good. I shouldn't start naming because I'm going to fail to name a lot of other groups that really do good work too. Yes.
Yeah, when I was a young man, there was a group of aims that would be in accord with what Christ would want us to do.
I know of no organization like that, but I do think we ought to be looking out for the very best people to run for office. I happen to think our process for the presidential nomination is not a good process. Once a president is in office, for example, you will devote one-third to one-half of your time on international affairs. When you look at the presidents we've had in recent times, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, the senior George Bush, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan. The only one of those, Gerry Ford and Richard Nixon. Gerry Ford, Richard Nixon, and the senior George Bush had international experience. The others had none, or virtually none. And it shows. I remember when we had we went into Somalia. To back up a little bit, and you have to tell me when my time is up here, Bob. Okay. I went into Somalia, and I came back on a Sunday night. And Monday morning, I called Boutros Ghali, the Secretary General of the UN, and I said, you have 500 Pakistani troops holed up at the airport at Mogadishu. The UN Security Council authorized 3,500 troops. I said, you've got to get these additional 3,000 troops there fast, and I just pulled a number out of the hat, I said, and get another 10,000 troops there quickly. And he said, well, we're going to send the additional 3,000 by ship. And I said, thousands of people are going to die while you're getting them by ship. And he said, well, your country charges us too much for the use of the planes. And I said, could we count it against UN dues? We owed a lot at that point. And he said, yes. So I called Larry Eagleburger, who was then the Secretary of State, and I said, Larry, will you call Boutros Ghali and see if we can't get something worked out, and will you also tell the President what the situation is? And I said I would call the President, but he was burying his mother that day, and I just didn't feel I should be contacting him, and I knew that Larry would be talking to the President. And then that Thursday, the senior President Bush called a meeting of about three of us in Congress, plus the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, and then made a decision to go into Somalia, and it saved hundreds of thousands of lives. In my opinion, while some places they still talk about the Somalia disaster, the real disaster was all the people who died and George Bush's finest hours when he sent the troops in. But we had, after we were there for a while, a retired American admiral who was working for the UN made a decision without consulting General Zini, who was the U.S. commander in that area, without consulting Bob Oakley, who was our ambassador, who knew the situation. And we had 18 American service personnel killed, one of them dragged through the streets. And immediately there were calls on the floor of the Senate and House, get our troops out of Somalia. And they called a meeting at the White House, President Clinton did. He hadn't been in office too long then. And we had about a two-hour meeting, and we worked out an agreement that our troops would stay until March, which was, I didn't like it, but it was a practical compromise. But Bill Clinton was just, he changed and became very much on top of foreign affairs. But at that point, just was not aware of, what was going on and just didn't provide leadership. And we're in that situation too often with presidents, including the current president, that just don't have background in foreign affairs. And that is a major problem. And I would add we need members of the House and Senate with that kind of background, too. And it was on the floor of the Senate, I said, if we just pull out because 18 Americans are killed, the lesson to terrorists around the world is kill Americans and then we're going to pull out. And it's very interesting that Osama bin Laden used Somalia as an example of why they used the planes on the World Trade Center. He said the Americans are a paper tiger. They showed that in Somalia. But we need, I don't have a good answer to your question, we need more people in government who have a sensitivity to the international situation. Again, let me just thank everyone. You have been great. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Statuary.